The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a deportation law this week. The law allowed for the deportation of immigrants convicted of some crimes. The case saw conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch join the court's liberal members in the majority opinion. This comes before the court hears a challenge next week to the travel restrictions President Trump placed on 8 countries, most of which are predominantly Muslim. That ruling could have big implications for presidential powers over issues of immigration. Adam Liptak is a Supreme Court reporter at the New York Times. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Let's start with that deportation case. Can you give us some background on what this law would have allowed?
Sure. The law allows the deportation of people convicted of crimes of violence. But Congress, when it enacted this statute, was very vague about what it meant. And the court has struggled with how to interpret that phrase, both in the criminal context and in the immigration context. The person at the center of this case, a guy named DeMaia, had been convicted of residential burglary. Not clear whether that's a crime of violence or not. And the court said here, as in the criminal context, in the immigration context, that the law was too vague. That if Congress wants to make people eligible for deportation, it can. But it has to specify what crimes it's talking about. And so it's probably not surprising that the court's 4 more liberal members went in that direction. A bit more of a surprise that President Trump's appointee, Justice Neil Gorsuch, did. But he has a commitment to reading statutes narrowly and to calling Congress to account if it's too vague. So maybe it's not wholly surprising that you get a 5-4 decision in that direction. And there are calls for Congress to make the statute more precise, and it might well do so.
And the concern was, and it sounded like courts were reading this different ways, that burglary, well, a burglary could result in violence. And some courts were saying, okay, yeah, that fits this vague description. Other courts were saying, no, it has to actually involve actual violence.
That's exactly right. So judges had a hard time with it. And it also didn't give, the majority said, people subject to the law fair notice about what kind of conduct would get you in what kind of trouble. And for things as serious as being incarcerated or being deported, it's at least a fair point to raise that the Constitution seems to require, as a matter of due process, that you know what conduct will result in what kind of punishment.
And these are things that would fall sometimes under the purview of the Department of Homeland Security. Have they responded to this U.S. Supreme Court ruling?
They sure did, and they were plenty unhappy, and they said that this will subject communities to potential violence, and they called on Congress to fix the law to make it more precise.
Is this something that's going to end up bouncing back to lower courts, or is it up to Congress now to decide whether or not they want to fix it as the Supreme Court sees it?
Well, so going forward, it's pretty clear that this part of the law has been struck down. So if it's going to be fixed going forward, it's up to Congress. Looking backward, it's a little more complicated whether people who've been made eligible for deportation under this law can challenge that. And that will depend on all kinds of various procedural doctrines. So the courts will have a large role to play for people already subject to the law. Going forward, I think it's up to Congress.
Talking to Adam Liptak from the New York Times, looking at some immigration cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. And a big one people are watching for, Adam, the long, complicated story of these travel bans from, it was a varying number of countries. This current one, I believe, is 8 countries, mostly Muslim majority countries, 6 out of the 8. Where are we on this? This has bounced around so much.
Yeah, so we're up to the 3rd version of the travel ban. All 3 versions challenged in the court, all 3 versions struck down in the lower courts. You'll remember that just a week after President Trump took office, he issued his first travel ban, resulting in chaos at the airports and lots of lawsuits. The 2nd version made it to the Supreme Court, but it was dismissed as moot when the 3rd version came in. But this 3rd version, which is the result of some substantial interagency study and is unlike the first 2 versions meant to be permanent, now is going to face next Wednesday a Supreme Court review. And we are going to get a decision in this case and probably one that will make a major statement on the scope of presidential power in the area of immigration and national security.
And a couple unusual things in this case, it seems like. One was what Donald Trump, then candidate Donald Trump, said about banning Muslims while he was on the campaign trail, and questions about whether that matters in how we assess this particular travel ban. What's going on?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So the government takes the view that the courts should just look at the words of the executive order, that it should ignore the context of, you know, fairly strident statements by candidate Trump about wanting to ban all Muslims, approving statements by candidate Trump about a dark moment in the nation's history when President Roosevelt sent 110,000 Japanese Americans to internment camps. And even after he's elected, he continued to, in somewhat milder ways, but nonetheless, draw connections to his earlier statements and talking about he didn't want to be politically correct, that he started to talk about territories rather than Muslims. But you sure had the sense that it was the president's intention to follow through on something like what he had promised as a candidate. Now, his lawyers say that the role of the courts is not to look behind the executive order, but just to assess it as if any president had adopted it. And that's going to be a question at Wednesday's argument about how much the court will take account of what seems to have been, at least at one point, Donald Trump's intentions.
And the main question there, I guess, then is, are these travel bans a religious bias? Is this judging people solely on the basis of their religion? Is that the question they're trying to answer them?
Yeah, so there are two major questions in the case. You're quite right to say one of them is this constitutional question of does this violate the Constitution's protection of religious freedom by singling out one religious group for to disfavor that group. And the face of the executive order doesn't say that. It talks about nations. Sure, six of the eight are majority Muslim. Actually, one of those six, Chad, has recently been taken off the list. But nonetheless, the roughly 150 million people affected are very, very predominantly Muslim. Now, there are many more Muslims in the world than are in those five or six countries. But nonetheless, it disproportionately affects Muslims. So the constitutional question is this a kind of religious discrimination that violates the First Amendment's protection of religious freedom? There's a second question in the case, too, and that's the ground on which the Ninth Circuit ruled, and it's the Ninth Circuit decision that's before the court, which is Congress gives the president a lot of authority over immigration, but not unlimited authority. And the statute seemed to call for him to make findings that are based on reason and common sense. And it's the argument on the other side is that there's really no good connection between why are you excluding wholesale people from these nations and not other nations, and did Congress authorize the president to make these determinations?
We're talking to Adam Liptak, senior Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about these Supreme Court cases on immigration, the deportation argument we heard earlier, or the travel ban challenge, the discussion, the hearings coming up next week? What do you think the court should rule on the travel ban? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Adam Liptak is with us, Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, looking at some of the court's latest moves on immigration issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this travel ban being argued before the Supreme Court next week? How are you hoping the court rules? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Charlie is on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I thought the reason for the countries named was not due to the religion that predominated in that nation, but rather the nation's inability to appropriately screen and vet the people who would be traveling to the United States. I mean, if it was religion, it would be based on religion, not on the ability of the country to appropriately vet the people. And all these nations have been shown and put on a list by the Obama administration as being unable to appropriately screen those people.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Adam, that's part of the argument, I believe, from the Trump administration, right?
That is the government's argument. That is supposedly the conclusion of a report the government prepared, although the report's never been made public. The other side disputes that and says, moreover, that wholesale shutting down of every national of a given country because that country doesn't supply information to the United States is not the appropriate response. But individualized vetting of people who want to come to the United States is the better approach.
Charlie, thanks for the call. We'll go next to George in Milwaukee. George, hi.
Yes, hi. Perhaps your guest can elucidate on this. I have heard many stories about people who are not violent criminals and perhaps have only just been arrested because they came in illegally. And I'm wondering, is the court going to be looking at this at all, not just people who have been termed violent?
George, thanks for the call. So getting back to that deportation case we mentioned, how widely will this affect how people are arrested and or deported, Adam? Or is this a pretty narrow group of people involved?
So the court looks at all kinds of immigration issues, and the caller raises an important separate question from this one. This one was looking at people, say, who are lawful residents but not citizens, who commit a crime, and as a consequence of that crime may or may not be deportable depending on how serious the crime is. The separate question of whether people who are not authorized to be here in the first place, which of them should be deported and when and how long can they be held in immigration detention and while those decisions are made, that's the subject of a whole separate set of cases, and the court has an active immigration docket. There are many immigration laws, and it's looking hard at them, and it has gone both ways on them. So just in February, the conservative majority of the court, in that instance, joined by Justice Gorsuch, said that people seeking asylum in the United States, say, or fighting their deportations, say, can be held for very long periods of time in immigration detention and are not entitled to bail hearings to be released on bond, even if they're not a threat to the community or a threat of flight. So the court has an active immigration docket, and it's trying to fine-tune all these laws.
George, thanks a lot for that call. Adam, I wanted to ask about something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned the president referring to the Japanese internments during World War II, Japanese-American internments, I should say. And I think it was one of your pieces you pointed out that that was approved by the U.S. Supreme Court at the time, generally looked back on as one of the worst U.S. Supreme Court decisions in history, but it's never been overturned. It could still theoretically be used as precedent.
That's right. So President Roosevelt issued an executive order in 1942 that led to the internment of more than 110,000 Japanese Americans, most of them American citizens, and that's a dark moment in the nation's history. In 1944, in a case called Korematsu, the court said that was okay, and these days almost everybody thinks that Korematsu ranks with the very worst Supreme Court decisions, ranks with Dred Scott and Plessy v. Ferguson. And so it was a little bit of a surprise early in President Trump's candidacy in December of 2015 when he spoke approvingly of that episode. He didn't talk about the Supreme Court decision, but it's, as you say, Rob, it is still on the books. I don't think the court would ever cite it, but nor has it ever overruled it.
And I wanted to get into, before we run out of time, speculation about a Supreme Court retirement. We're kind of always playing this game, it seems like. But there's talk about Justice Kennedy maybe retiring this year. What are you looking at? What are the odds makers saying about this?
You know, last year when it looked like last year it seemed very much on the table. He's since settled into his role a little bit more. He's retained his decisive vote on the court, which he would have lost had Hillary Clinton become president. He's 81 years old, and it's certainly possible, but I think the odds are a tiny bit lower now than they were last year. And if I had to bet, I bet he'd stick around. But should Justice Kennedy go, it will be a transformative moment for the court because he has cast the deciding vote for so long. And if President Trump gets to replace him, he'll replace a moderate conservative who not infrequently votes with the liberals in cases like on gay rights and abortion and affirmative action with a hardcore conservative. And that will move the court court substantially to the right.
Right. No one would appoint another Justice Kennedy. It seems like a Democrat would try to get somebody way to the liberal side of things, Republican the other way around. Is the Supreme Court justice thinking about that? They're not going to, my view won't be represented if I leave?
Political scientists say they do try to take account of that. It's a little hard to game your retirement just right. And as you say quite correctly, Rob, Kennedy's in a particularly tough spot because it's not like you can wait around for the next president and know that that's going to be pretty close to where you are ideologically. He's sort of in this middle ground, and polarized America no longer exists.
And it's kind of a weird institution that we have people in their 80s postponing retirement maybe indefinitely.
That's right, and he's not the oldest justice. Justice Ginsburg is 85. Justice John Paul Stevens worked until he was 90. And so you have people who are sort of legacies of an entirely different historical era. Justice Kennedy was appointed by Ronald Reagan, and yet he's still the most important vote on the most important court in the nation.
We'll leave it there for now. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was great to be here.
Adam Liptak is a Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. He was getting us up to speed on immigration cases coming before the court, the big travel ban argument coming up next week, plus speculation that Justice Anthony Kennedy could retire this year. He says he doesn't think that's going to happen. Over the last week, wildlife groups around the state have been getting reports of starving and dying robins, purple martins, and other species traveling north for the spring. The songbirds have been hobbled by the unseasonable weather. Snow has made it hard for the birds to catch insects or search for other food. Marge Gibson is the executive director of the Raptor Education Group, Incorporated. She talked to Central Time producer Jay Carlisle Larson about the problem.
Marge, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What is the scope of the problem right now as you're seeing it?
Well, it's very difficult now. The birds that are coming up are basically insect eaters, and this is their normal time to migrate into our area. It's just our weather that's abnormal, unfortunately, and they're caught in a very difficult situation. They are the early migrators, and so they do have a little flexibility, especially robins, but they do need to reach soil to be able to have some access to some sort of invertebrate that's in the soil, and that's not possible. We still have 3 feet of snow up here, and it's still been very, very cold.
Now, as you just said, this is the early sort of waves of this migration, but as you've been dealing with birds that are in distress, how significant of an impact is this going to have in the next couple of weeks?
Well, it started off we were wondering what was happening. We saw a few robins come in, but we thought maybe they had been a flock that came and then would go back south. But unfortunately, south was also not very safe for them at that point because this inclement weather has been happening, for most of the Midwest. So we then started getting many calls about robins being on the ground and people being able to walk up to them and pick them up. And that, of course, is very alarming. If you can walk up to a wild bird and pick it up, it definitely is having problems and needs to be taken to a rehab center. And that's where we started getting the word out. Then we started hearing even worse things, robins at roost, nighttime roosts, and people were trying to feed them and do provide them with some insects and, dried mealworms and things like that, and finding 50, 60 of them dead overnight. It's pretty devastating.
And what are some of the symptoms, or what are you seeing these birds when they are coming in? What are they displaying?
Well, the public first sees what they think is a very fat robin or a warbler or one of the even killdeer. We've had killdeer come in too. And they're very fluffed up. And so people presume that means they're very fat. And, of course, it's the actual opposite. They puff up when they're trying to keep warm. It's like their version of our layers in cold weather, and they try to get air caught between their feathers so they can maintain heat. Then they tuck their head under their wing during the daytime. They're not really sleeping. They're just really in desperate straits, and that's those are the signs that people see. They try to eat at feeders, but they're not really eating. They're just sort of going through the motions.
You said that people have been able to just walk up and pick up some of these birds. For people who are worried about a bird that they think is in distress, first, what should they be on the lookout for, and what should they do in this situation?
Well, if you have a flock of robins or warblers or any of the insect eaters at your in your area, you can provide food, obviously, the best food you can. Sometimes it's crumbled up suet cakes that have little insects in them. The suet itself has is very high calorie and high protein, of course, so those things are good. Dried mealworms, things like that. If you're supplying that at your feeder or on the ground around your feeder, that's good. So if they're just a flock there and they look hungry and they are eating, that's the best thing you can do. You can open up areas, move snow away from areas so there is ground exposed so they can start having some natural exposure to their own elements. Those are good things. Also, keep your dog and cat indoors because these birds are compromised and they're very easy to become prey to something like a dog or a cat.
Marge, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
That was Marge Gibson, Executive Director of the Raptor Education Group, Incorporated. She talked to Central Time producer J. Carlisle Larson about how the unseasonable snow and cold is impacting migrating songbirds and what people can do to help. Have you seen this problem in your part of the state with the two mid-April snowstorms we've had just over the course of the last week? Have you brought birds to rehab or tried to feed them yourself? Do you work in bird rehab yourself? We'd love to hear from you. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org, or you can message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, let us know if you're seeing these problems with birds after this unseasonable April snow.